G'day there, Mick Meredith here, comedian, musician and podcaster, and I'm doing the opening spot on the Andy Social podcast. He's coming up in a minute, settle down. If you don't know me, Mick Meredith, I tell jokes and sing songs. I've put out a couple of tunes recently on Spotify, one called Rod, all about my girlfriend's love for another man. Oh yeah, that's funny, we all laugh about it. Another tune about turning 50 called Hitting the Half Century and Growing Old Disgracefully. So check them out on Spotify or whatever platform you listen to. Got some other projects coming up soon. A new song coming out called Where's the Effing Remote Control? I think we can all relate to that. But right now, tune your ears in to the Andy Social Podcast. Cheers, big ears.
This episode of the Andy Social Podcast is proudly brought to you by these legends over at Patreon. Thank you very much to Andrew from Perth, Mick G from Sydney, Ash from Deniliquin, Dan from Dapto, Rod from Rayleigh in North Carolina, Patrick from Canberra, Liam from Brisbane. Who else we got? Brendo from Leeton, Tim from Canberra, James from Brisbane, Christian from Canberra, and Steve from the Gold Coast. Thank you very much, guys. These people are my top tier supporters over at Patreon, part of the larger community of awesome people who support this podcast and ensure that the podcast continues to chug along in 2021. Supports us from only $1 a month, dirt cheap, and there are additional tiers if you want access to exclusive things such as the Patreon podcast that comes out every week, also the USB pass with the first 100 episodes of the podcast and free t-shirts as well, plus a bunch of other things that I'll be adding to Patreon over the coming months. Go and check it all out over at patreon.com/AndyDowling. Hey, episode 269 of the Andy Social Podcast is here, and joining me on the potty this episode is Alex Wilson of Sleep Makes Waves. This is a band that I absolutely love. I've been following them since their infancy. I've seen them play in all sorts of nooks and crannies around Sydney. We in Lord even played a show with Sleep Makes Waves back in the day. A really weird show at Utopia Records, of all places, which was a lot of fun, but kind of weird. We talk a little bit about that in this chat, but nonetheless, please go and check out Sleep Makes Waves by going to sleepmakeswaves.com. Go and check out their latest album / EP trilogy called These Are Not Your Dreams over at Bandcamp. So you can go to sleepmakeswaves.bandcamp.com. But of course, everything that we discuss will be in the show notes over at andysocial.net and andydowling.net. Alex came to my place not too long ago to have this chat. And there's a little bit of a cameo from Larry Burb, my little cockatiel. So a little bit of an interruption, but we made it work. So hopefully you'll enjoy the side commentary from Larry throughout this episode. But a great chat, and I really hope that you guys enjoy it. So enough crapping on from me. Please enjoy this great chat with Alex Wilson of Sleep Makes Waves. Thanks for stopping by.
It's an absolute pleasure. Cheers for having me.
Yeah, no worries. We've got Larry in the background. He literally just whistled then, and I was just saying to you before how he might chime in. I was trying to think of like a place to start because, you know, you go online and you're looking at all the bios and just a few interviews here and there, and a lot of it's pretty generic sort of stuff. It's the usual sort of Q&A based stuff. And I'm a pretty gullible guy, so I could be wrong with this one, but I was reading the bio on your website. And you were talking about how I think one of the albums hit the top 100 in Kazakhstan. Is that a joke as part of the bio, as a little bit of a tinge of humour? Larry's thinking it's a joke. Or was that an actual thing?
G'day, Larry. You know, I really wish I could give you a definitive answer about that. Like, I guess knowing us, it feels like a coin toss. It could be 50% true, or it could be 50%... something that our manager Mike put in there to catch like unwary people in the industry. Like, there is a really good thing that we did at a gig in Tasmania where on our rider we put these like really strange items down on the rider, sort of like a first edition of I think it was of like the King James Bible or something like that. And one of them, and this is maybe not like the best thing that we should have put down, but the phrase was, I think, like a Guatemalan servant boy with dreamy eyes, right? And then there was actually in this place in Tasmania, a guy who worked the bar that was Guatemalan. And so they sort of like dressed him up in this kind of like very cliched sort of like servant outfit and had him be the guy that would have to provide us with our beers and the rider stuff the whole time. So, you know, that thing about Kazakhstan, I feel that could be a sort of Mike Solo joke that's put in there to catch the unawares.
Well, I was very close because I read it and I went, oh, okay, that's a little bit unusual. And then I thought, okay, maybe this, yeah, as you said, 50-50, could go either way here. Yeah. Like, so there you go. Now, we've got Larry really going off here, so let's, hey,
come on. Oh, what an adorable little thing.
Are you okay with birds?
Yeah, totally.
Hey. Alright, you alright? Okay, come here for a bit. We'll see how this goes. This is the first podcast where I've ever had him out.
There we go.
Okay, so just to bring everyone back, I've literally got Larry on my shoulder here, so he may chime in every once in a while. Yeah, okay. So he's just woken up, so we'll see how this goes. I might have to take another pause at some point, but there we go, just working on the fly.
I'll just have to try and concentrate because it's just too easy to get dreamily lost up in adorable little Larry there perched on your shoulder.
He's now talking into the mic, or he's shadow talking. So, there you go. So we'll see how this goes. But yeah, there you go. So I guess, I mean, having someone like Mike and that label, I've just over the years, and not to make this a podcast about record labels and all this sort of stuff, but they appear to have had some sort of edge with a lot of their artists. And I think it's probably helped like you guys and a bunch of other bands to really sort of get noticed beyond like that, initially that very underground, very, very niche sort of circles. And, you know, I mean, these days now, in the past few years, I mean, you guys have, you know, had award recognition, like mainstream success recognition. You guys have done big headline shows and toured internationally, but I think a lot of that's probably come from actually a willingness to actually go, well, we're better than just that small niche circle, that underground, and can we take a risk and go into a wider audience?
Yeah, I think there are probably two major reasons for why that's happened, I guess, apart from just the fact that, like every other band, we're trying to do the best music that we can do and the best live show that we can put on. I think that's something that like every artist is out there trying to do. So I don't really look at that as being the big differentiator. I think with a bit of hindsight, I think it was the fact that we were sometimes willing to put the rest of our lives on hold to a kind of ridiculous extent that maybe other people that had more legitimate commitments than we had in that sort of heavy period of our lives were able to do. So there was kind of just a real gung-ho-ness that I think we could kind of manage. And then Mike was kind of the brains of the operation behind that. You know, we were sort of, I guess, managing that whole process of committing to the road and emotionally what that requires and how you structure your life around that. And then Mike was definitely the person that had the really acute rational brain for positioning us in the marketplace while we were doing that. And, you know, I guess that's ultimately what it is. That's what you're getting a manager to do. So I think it does... I think it has made a difference. And as a musician, it makes me feel pretty humble. You know, it's sort of not just about what you do, but there's this whole aspect of my career and the things that I've enjoyed that's, you know, down to this guy that has a set of capabilities I just simply cannot do. Like, I can't go and talk to people, you know, positively about my career and sort of like hustle for those opportunities. That's just too much of like a difficult thing that I want nothing to do with. So it's always a benefit, I think, for musicians to have someone who can effectively do that for you without any of your hang-ups and bullshit, you know, getting in the way of doing it.
It's tough. And I guess, I mean, I'm making an assumption here, but at that point where you guys made a decision and maybe you just connected with Mike by chance or whatever that first engagement was, but no doubt, I mean, for you, I mean, I assume this is your baby. I mean, it's been your baby since day dot. To not necessarily let go of a lot of it, but to let go of aspects of it where you've got somebody who can come in and direct you guys. I mean, manage you guys. I mean, that's the role he plays. Is that
he definitely tells us what to do at points. For sure.
Was that tough at all at times, just to sort of let a little bit of the control away?
I think if I'm honest, it was tough. And I think being human, I often didn't really sort of like admit to myself that part of what is difficult is sort of starting a project. And as you say, being there from day dot and being very emotionally invested in it and having preconceptions about sort of what success should look like.
Yeah.
And then you've got this person collaborating with you, doing an amazing job, who probably has a better idea than you of what success looks like.
Yeah.
You know, we've definitely probably, butted heads over that issue before, and I would sort of look back at us and say I've probably been like pretty stubborn and childish over like certain things at points, you know.
Yeah,
so I think that is definitely an aspect of it, and I think part of the things for me about sort of being more mature as a musician is just making your peace with that side of the music world, I suppose. There's a whole creative aspect in the playing live that feels really authentic and real.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of the business hustle, the marketing yourself, the promoting, the metrics, the numbers, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And a lot of the time that doesn't feel good.
Mm.
And ultimately I've just come to a point of like being grateful for the fact that there's someone really good handling that side of it for me. Yeah.
It would have taken a while to sort of build. I mean, I don't know what the prior relationship was, but I guess for anybody to come in and do a little bit of directing, you know, there's a bit of trust that needs to be built to ensure that, you know, the vision of how you want to be perceived out there in the public domain versus the vision of somebody else coming in thinking, well, I've got a bunch of ideas. You've got to try and find some alignment there. And that can be really tough because I'm a control freak myself with everything. I have a real hard time letting go of things and trying to, I mean, we were just talking earlier about having a few people around you to help you sort of keep things afloat and keep things moving. And for me, that's something I want to keep pushing and getting more people to help me. But it's a case of going, I need to be able to trust people that ultimately it's for the greater good of what I've initially created. So I assume that it would have taken a little bit just to build the trust and sort of get to a point where you can sort of let that aspect of it go.
I think that it did take time for the sort of our relationship to deepen to the level that it's got at the moment. I think initially for us, when Mike came in, he immediately managed to facilitate for us a bunch of opportunities that we hadn't been able to do before. We were coming off the back of sort of a particular time in Australian live music that you probably remember. I don't know if all listeners would, but, you know, pre-sale gigging was quite rampant. You know, it was like the sort of real bad old days of sort of pokies stuff in Sydney. So it was a hard time, and it was not easy to find good people. So finding someone like Mike who had his heart in the right place and also this ability to make stuff happen. I think initially there was this real honeymoon period. He comes along, we release this record. He manages to get people in the industry to take notice, and then we can do cool stuff like go overseas and play shows. And so I think initially there's just this massive feeling of gratefulness. And then I think after that sort of comes a bit like any relationship, the honeymoon period abates. You get used to this new normal of things that, you know, you totally lusted after in a previous life. Now you kind of have them. They're the new normal. And you can then begin to feel comfortable griping about like a new set of things. And then there's this manager here that, you know, is maybe telling you stuff that you don't want to hear some of the time. And that's probably like the difficult part.
Mm.
And I think, and that's also when we were, you know, learning how to be a touring band and how to handle ourselves, you know, on the road and do all that kind of stuff. So you're right, it did take some time. And there's definitely been some ebbs and flows in sort of how we felt about our management. But I think at this point, we've kind of arrived at a place where we feel, you know, relatively comfortable with where we sit in the industry. So I suppose we're not putting so much pressure on ourselves, and thereby we don't have to put so much pressure on our manager to sort of make incredible things, you know, happen.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, obviously there's circles and a genre of music and bands that are sort of your contemporaries, as far as the type of music that you play. But I think starting out, I mean, there's at least one gig that we played together, which was a bit of a, I don't know if you remember, but we did an in-store thing at Utopia.
I do remember that one, yeah. I borrowed your bass rig. I remember that.
I mean, so those early days were really hit and miss sort of, you know, shows and different things. And for you guys, probably trying to find where your home is, especially in a local scene where there's probably, I mean, internationally, there's a lot of bands where you're pulling influences from and you're looking as far as a blueprint or potentially a direction to go. But locally in Sydney, it's probably not as much contemporaries or peers that you can sort of run alongside with. So to begin with, when you're playing all these shows and you're doing these mixed bills with these random bands and stuff like that, it's a weird question to ask, but given all the accolades and the things that have happened now, where something that on the surface seems to be a very niche style of music has brought you guys a lot more mainstream sort of attention. Did you guys have in the back of your mind or yourself personally that eventually you'll find the pieces that fit the puzzle and you'll be able to get to that point? Or was it just a case of, I don't know, just cruising along at that point in time, at least until Mike sort of came along?
I think it was cruising. I think when when I started, I can speak for myself most accurately here. Like when I started the band at that point, I was just very romantic about the idea of like being in a band and making music. Like it sounds silly, and I guess like in a way it is sort of just the nice thing of being a young person being really into it. But it's just like, I just wanted to make records, and like even sitting in like the little recording studios that we made, it was just magic, you know? And that was the big motivating thing. And I never really gave much thought to questions like how we could get more people to reach us. And so I think going back to what you sort of started off and sort of trying to talk about this bird's robe thing that Mike has created, and I suppose taking it away from sort of just talking about us to a certain extent, I think you're totally right. It's incredible how he has managed to take this niche style of music and expand it out. I think that's definitely to do with just his own unique genius for being able to make that happen. But I think it's also just kind of an interesting comment on how the music industry works in general over a long period. It's like when we started the band in the mid-2000s, like it was in this weird transition period from that kind of retro rock Strokes kind of vibe, then moving sort of through the kind of like indie discovery period, like embodied by like Mumford and Sons, and then sort of into, you know, some of the styles that are prominent today. And, you know, in that time we were so uncool, like we were really, really lame. And it's like, then we reached this point where it's like the same industry that like, 10 years prior would have written you off as very lame is now facing you with these accolades. And I'm not at all ungrateful, but I think having somewhat of an ironic attitude to it, I think is like pretty appropriate. You know, it's like, it's a very fickle world out there. So I think through it all, I've just tried to keep focused on like the fact that we have a fan base that are interested in what we put out, and they've stuck with us through the years. And they're the ones that mean that, like, we can sit here in our little home studios writing songs and feel like it's worth it, because we can put something out and there are people who will listen to it and it will matter to them and they'll have opinions about it. And that's definitely something worth holding on to, you know?
As you're talking, I'm definitely listening to you. I've got, I've got Larry here who got his foot stuck in my ponytail. Yeah. So I'm like, all right, how do we manage this? You can kind of look at it with a sort of these jaded eyes, and I'm always frustrated with trying to get recognition or trying to get attention, especially when you have a little glimmer of some success, or like even a couple of years ago when we put out the last album, and for us, I mean, talk about uncool. I mean, we're playing, you know, for a while there, all the edgelords on the internet were calling our style of music like bald metal, you know, it's like your dad's metal, yeah. You know, that's kind of stuff. And we're playing stuff that's traditionally sort of, you know, 80s heavy metal, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, very uncool. And it's not the stuff that's in the mainstream and stuff that often gets recognized. And so for us, like, we did the last album, and just by chance, I mean, we didn't even know it happened. Someone gave us a link and said, hey, heads up. And we're in the top 20 for the ARIA album charts for Aussie artists. And I mean, we probably just had a quiet week and we just got lucky and just got in at the right time. But for like an Aussie band, but like an Aussie band playing that type of metal, I mean, for me, I sort of almost put the mic hat on and thought, here's an angle. Like, here's something that I can create some momentum out of and potentially get some attention and start to milk it a little bit and try to make this cool, because there's some validation in the metrics here. But it just wasn't picked up whatsoever. And so I think it sort of really shows how much time and effort is put in and the creativity from people that work in sort of management roles away from us, because we were just in the midst of just doing the music and trying to play shows and do all this sort of stuff, where these guys are really becoming a little bit scientific about how they can create influence and get the right people, like the right people interested, and then creating that public affection. Because really it's a case of sort of like being at school, you know, you got, you know, the cool kids dictate what everybody else listens to or enjoys, or the fads or anything like that. Like, you know, one of the quieter guys or girls, like they might like something, but that's not going to pick up. It's the people who are the loudest, the influencers, they're the people that, you know, are dictating what's cool and what's not. So it's probably the same in mainstream, you know. You've got to find those people who are the loudest and can project and lead and influence. And, yeah, it's a tough thing to do, but it's really sort of time and place and a little bit of luck and perseverance. But yeah, so the whole mic thing, I mean, we're making a podcast about mic here. It just goes to show how much skills involved to sort of make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary the amount of stuff that you have to do to be a legitimate musician in 2020. I think it's quite a workload. It's sort of quite a mental strain. And so, yeah, like, I view myself as being pretty fortunate that, like, a large part of that is something that, due to the fortune of my own career, I've sort of never had to worry about to a great extent. One of the things that like, I suppose I ultimately think is a bit of, like, concerning in the industry is I suppose I'm not even so worried about the influences or people that are sort of turning themselves into content machines and sort of maybe forgetting about the musical side a bit. Like, that's an aesthetic choice. If people want to make it like their music career more of a personal brand thing than about like a back catalog, like, there are many ways to skin a cat, you know. Yeah. It's like, I'm not gonna complain about that too much. But I think what's really difficult now is that I try and imagine myself, if I was like 20 years old in 2020 and I wanted to try and break into the industry, it's a pretty grim looking picture.
Yep.
You know, it's like the thing that I did, which was to get into venues and play shows. Well, that's pretty hard for a variety of reasons. And then it's like social media is way more of a kind of centrally controlled monolith than it was back in the sort of Wild West MySpace days, you know, when it was a lot sort of more zany and free. And now it's sort of like, if you want to get your music out there, that whole, you know, playing live is hard. Getting through on the internet, it's like you have to basically invest money. That's what it comes down to. Yeah. You have to pay for the advertising. And Spotify has, you know, very successfully reinvented itself as like a new clothed emperor. Basically sort of the major label system with all the gatekeepers and all of the consolidated capital in a new guise. So it's sort of like, I actually think like the music industry rules today in a lot of ways. I sound like, you know, probably a real sob story. I actually think the diversity of genres and all of that stuff we were talking about, that side of things where we've arrived at is really good. But I think there are these sort of... it is really hard to cut through. And I think I sort of feel like the gratitude of like having established ourselves before it seemed to become this really overcrowded, intense self-promotional game based on this sort of whole social media hustle, which frankly I find quite intimidating.
Yeah,
you know,
it's really tough. And I think there was this period of time where, you know, the whole, you know, going back, well, probably closer to 20 years now, where you had all the Napster stuff that was going on, you know, CD sales were going down, record sales, all this sort of stuff. And so people were, air quotes, stealing music. And I think the industry really struggled then, and it took a long time for them to sort of recalibrate and work out, okay, well, we need to look at this completely different. And so for that period of time, I think in hindsight, and you never know when you're in the middle of it at the time, but looking back, it was probably a really good time for a lot of bands to get ahead and get that momentum going and establish themselves without, when while all the gatekeepers were sort of momentarily sort of displaced, not knowing what to do. Because as you said now, like they've sort of worked themselves out now for the most part. They've worked out a new structure, a new system. And so those, you know, and people still talk about it now. They're like, oh, you know, the gatekeepers are no longer there. It's not just, you know, a few record labels. It's like, no, it definitely is a few record labels. If anything, it's less record labels because they've all bought each other out, and they're holding all the cards. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do. So
this is going to be my like Alex Jones moment, like kind of like we're through the looking glass here, people. But I went to a music industry conference a few years back, and it was basically about self-management, and it was really striking to me how all of the people representing the biggest artists that, you know, so one of the things is they got big managers of Australian artists to come in and talk to you about what succeeds. And basically the artists that represented the big end of town, the sort of, you know, Sony backed kind of, you know, that kind of thing. They were also positive about streaming. They love it.
Yeah.
They love streaming. They love digital service provision. You know, they absolutely adore it. And so I think like it's a really interesting thing, and it worries me, I think, how that exact narrative that you said, this idea, this story that we're told, that it's like we have triumphed over this this sort of bad old time. But I think really it's managed to come back with a vengeance. And if you're kind of, I think, like a bit of an older fart, like, you know, you and I comparatively, you have a long enough memory to remember when we were told this before, and it didn't actually amount to what we were told it would.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a tricky one. I think one of my like personal projects at the moment is to sort of like really try and spread the word about how, you know, Spotify actually works economically, and how they calculate the user fees and who that goes to and everything like that, because ultimately it's a pretty rigged system, you know?
And I think the narratives that are out there, because it's quite confusing, because I think there's a narrative for musicians, independent musicians, I'll premise that, and also your average music listener, whether they be a dedicated music fan or more casual. And so, you know, they talk about sort of the different rates of pay per play and things like that, but it's not just standard across the board. Like, those cuts are completely different depending on how you're set up on that platform. Like, if you're, you know, if you're using an aggregator to put your music on there across multiple streaming platforms, if you're on a Sony or something like that, or if you're just going directly into Spotify itself, and it changes. And so I think there was one thing I saw, and I never looked into it, so you may have, but there was an article about how Spotify was willing to reduce your rate per play in exchange for getting more reach across their platform. So, I don't know, more of their editorial playlists or whatever it might be. So you get more plays, but your rate per play is going to go down as a result. So it's like, hey, we're willing to help you out. But
a payola system, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So that was like a recent thing that made the news. And I mean, like, to me, that kind of stuff is just sort of very, very transparent money grabbing that, like, I think most people kind of like look at and they're like, oh, yeah, that's pretty shit. Mm. But I think because we're also, I mean, I use Spotify. I'll like totally fess to that. It's like, as a consumer, it's fantastic. Yeah. Like, I love being able to just sort of, you know, like 16-year-old me who was just like on allmusic.com all the time looking for like 5-star records to listen to, but you had to pay $30 for one. So it was this huge thing. Like, just being able to listen to the history of music is like, it's incredible. But I think you got to wear two hats. And from the artist side of things, you know, you really see how the sausage is made, and you have the language to understand what's motivating the decisions, like the payola thing you talk about. The big one that I think is the real killer for me that most people don't seem aware of is what's called the pro rata system of basically dividing up the user fees. So like, to try and make it really simple, let's imagine there's a guy out there, and I know that there are people like this who exist, that like, you know, when you released your latest CD that month, they just spun Lord real heavy, you know? And so on Spotify, that would have been, you know, the majority, if not all, of what they were listening to. And Spotify's whole branding is sort of based around this idea that it's like your money supports the artist. Mm. Except the way they actually divvy it up is that guy's $15 or, you know, whatever he spends on Spotify. That's not going mainly to you, and it's not even going mainly to independent artists. Like, most of all the user fees are put in one big pile, and then they divvy that whole pile up according to who was listened to across the whole platform. So that guy who spent all of that month listening to Lord is also paying Lord with a D. Yeah. With an E on the end. You know, it's such a strange system, and like, it's not inherently right or wrong, but I think it comes back to this narrative idea that it's like, we're all told this thing that it's sort of like, you know, we all still think about it in terms of the buying the CD, the going into the shop, buying the CD, and sort of like paying the $30 to the artist. Yeah. But all of the stuff that's happening behind the scenes, it's not so transparent. And it really is, I think, structured to keep the richest people in music still rich.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really conflicted about it because I've spoken about it before and on this podcast before, so people listening probably heard me crap on about it. But I'm so like, and this comes from my own sort of shortcomings earlier in life when I was a little bit, I'm still not overly mature, but a little bit less mature than I am now. And, you know, I'm really just trying to get away from that whole sort of victim mentality. And one thing that I think a lot of musicians do themselves a disservice is that they focus on what's wrong rather than trying to fix something, or actually just trying to make sure their backyard's nice and clean first before they start hanging shit on everybody else. And so that's why you have a local scene sometimes that doesn't flourish, because they'll keep playing at the Lewisham, you know, every week and not try to do anything else and complain about how they're not getting any other opportunities. So, long way of getting to the point, but with Spotify, I'm really conflicted because there's a lot that's wrong with the system. But as you said, like, from a consumer point of view, it's fantastic. And me trying to think glass half full from an artist perspective, I think, well, if I can get that reach, and I would never compromise like any deal with Spotify to be able to do this, but if I'm getting more of a reach, then that means that there's potentially an awareness where I could direct them to, you know, a Patreon or to my Bandcamp, or, you know, to potentially buy a t-shirt or buy a CD, or eventually when we can tour again, to come to a show. Because I always think that the people that are going to support you are going to support you no matter what. And prior to streaming services, I mean, I used this example a while back, but, you know, I used to go on fly shows for our own band. And I'd be trying to aim for the guys in the priest shirts and the maiden shirts and thinking, oh, high chance of conversion there. And like real sales tactics, you know, getting out there, hustling. And, you know, some guys would go, yeah, cool, blah, blah, blah. But then at the end of the night, you can see most of them on the ground. And so you've always got in the back of your heads like 3 to 4% are actually going to probably make the effort to take it home, let alone actually go and type in a website or look them up afterwards. So I sort of think with all this stuff online now, it's sort of the same, just different tool or different system in place where really, I mean, are we still aiming for that same 3 or 4% out of the masses who are trying to convert? And is it just the case that, you know, streaming is what it is? I mean, I guess how much can we change? How much do we dwell on it? Because part of me wants to fight it and boycott it. But I think we just burn ourselves by doing it.
I totally get what you're saying. And I will like put a full disclaimer that like I am a very egregious hater and like part of my life's work. anyone who knows me well listening to this will know that like my life's work is to become a less egregious hater. So I think that like that aspect is really true. And like I think you do speak the truth. I've like heard sentiments from sort of like my independent scene in Sydney where they sort of say things like anyone who is in a band and doesn't work a full-time job is somehow like a poser or like not authentic or
yeah.
And that stuff doesn't get us anywhere, right? So no. So I agree. I think the conclusion I've come to personally is that like the cat's out of the bag. We're not getting back to a time in which money came in the door the same way it did when people sold CDs for $30 at HMV or at indie record stores. I think I've tried to be motivated by two things, which is that like I've had the benefit of being successful in music. I was really fortunate that for a couple of years I could actually pay the rent using the band. And that was a nice gravy train to ride. And I suppose like I want more people to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm motivated by the idea not of beating up on the punters who I think are just nice people who want to listen to music. But I guess if I could say that maybe some of this stuff with Spotify, it's worth us as an industry and particularly as artists, you know, finding a way to have this conversation about how it affects us and how we can advocate for an economic future that's like better for all of us. And if our kids want to sort of join bands and do some of the things that we do, I think we'd like it to be easier and better for them. Like if they decided to, try and commit themselves to music and put out quality stuff, that they could really see remuneration for that. And I think that's the main thing that just sort of worries me. So it's sort of like this balance between being a hater, but also trying to have the critical spirit to sort of not just, accept what Daniel Ek, you know, wants you to think about the situation, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, it's definitely a balanced approach that you have to take. And I think I'm sure you're similar to me we're music fans, you know, so you want to be able to sort of appreciate music and make it as easy as possible to be a music fan, but also to not get absolutely slammed and compromised as an artist as well. And it's always like all this stuff online, all this noise is great. I just got totally distracted by Larry then, who's attacking my hand here.
On you, Larry.
He's getting restless now. I think it's all coming from a good place, all the noise that's on the internet, the frustration from artists. And as you said before, and I think it's a good point, I think as frustrated as we can be as artists, understanding how the system is still there, it's just working in a different way against us. You don't want the punter, you don't want the music fan to feel like they are to blame for what's happening. Because there's a million memes out there about how poor us old poor musicians are and how we you know, I think last year, you know, everyone's saying, you know, we're not touring anymore and so no one's buying our merch, but then everyone's on Spotify streaming our music and so where's the money coming in? And there's truth to it, absolutely. But I think the more that you sort of highlight, it's the way that you message it. I think that's what it is. Because I think if people feel like they're being attacked or they feel guilty, some people will improve and go, I'm a little bit more intentional now. I'm going to buy a t-shirt. I'm going to buy the digital download from Bandcamp or whatever it is. But other people will just push away just out of pure spite. Sort of like a political thing when you get polarizing sort of opinions. And
it is very polarized. Yeah. It's. I think another way to sort of think about our requests as like artists is think about if we're in a different occupation. Like my partner, she's a teacher.
Yeah.
And right, so it's like teachers go out and they sort of, you know, she's a public school teacher, so they say like, you know, we need better conditions, you know, we need wage rises and stuff like that. And there are some people out in the world that will sort of listen to people like teachers saying that, and I'll be like, oh, well, I need a raise, you know, I need a raise. And sort of like, they don't work as hard. They have like these really long holidays. Yeah. So why aren't I getting that? And I suppose like ultimately as artists, when we, I think part of us, it's a difficult thing in Australia because we have such that, you know, like everyone talks about the tall poppy syndrome, but it's true. It's like we are very hard pressed to like feel proud of our perspective and like advocate for what we know in our bones is correct, you know? And I think we have to be prepared to take some hits, or risk pissing off people who aren't in the industry, who don't know it from the side that we do, that will just see us as being sort of like people that have a really great life who are just pointlessly complaining. But I think that's why it's good for me to keep the sort of perspective of like, what will it be like for future musicians? Ultimately, like all this in shouldn't be an aid of like bagging on the punters or feeling sorry for yourself. Like, hopefully it should all amount to like a better industry where we actually sort of like have the abundance of everyone being able to listen to all the music they want for minimal cost, and the people who create it can actually be remunerated fairly for their time. Like, the money actually already exists in the industry for that to happen. Like, it is capable. So I think in that sense, that's why I'm sort of like cheerfully dogged in just sort of like staying on the course for that kind of thing. Cause it's like, what a dream if we could get there, that would be amazing.
And I think it's definitely spinning it in an optimistic light as well. And as you said, like the money is there. It's not like people aren't spending the money. I mean, you know, one of those paths that bands have started to go down now, and I've done it for the podcast, not so much the band, but like things like Patreon and stuff like that, where you're creating small communities of people, very niche, but they're your community, and you don't need 100,000 fans or anymore. You maybe need 1,000 or maybe 100, you know, just to get started and start to earn some money. So, I mean, that's not the answer in isolation. Alone.
It kind of is though, I think. And if I can like jump in there, it's like Patreon is great, you know, and I don't use Patreon because I think it's fantastic, but like I at the moment would feel too much pressure to actually like create something fantastic for people.
That's the same for us with our band, same thing.
You know, and so I respect people that have gone down that road, and I think like it was interesting listening to Mike Mills on the podcast and how he talked about his particular project really fitting that that well. But Patreon's great because it actually like it is fundamentally motivated by creating a community, and if you succeed in creating a community as you have, the model is such that you will be like fairly remunerated. Like you will get most of the money for the community that you've created. And the reason, I guess, tying it back to what I was banging on about Spotify with that kind of esoteric, you know, thing about the pro rata system and how that money is divvied up, is ultimately it means if you create a community of people that devotedly listen to your music, if they devotedly listen to it on Spotify, you're not fucking getting anywhere. It's I think the Patreon model and the idea of people being able to see the majority of the income that is generated from making that community around a piece of art or a content creator. People need to be empowered by having the majority of that money go into their pocket, not into the basic, you know, the owners of capital who have created systems in which they own all of the content that's created on it and then rent it out to the consumer paying a pittance to the people that are labouring to make it.
Yeah.
You know?
You think, I mean, I pay the whatever it is, $18 a month for the family sort of thing on Patreon. And so over the year, that adds up. And I think for a lot of music fans who aren't buying merchandise and aren't going to shows and things like that, people who are paying that for that premium subscription are probably paying more than they ever have before for music. So as you said, like the early bit, like the money is there. And maybe it's a case that thinking about sort of Patreon models and things like that is, you know, you have a platform like Spotify that becomes a little bit more niche down, where you could pay an amount of money per month that gets you maybe a genre, and that money's allocated to the genre as such. And then you could pay a smaller amount, which gives you a smaller percentage of something that's a little bit outside that genre. And so based on how much you want to access, you pay more and more. It's a tiered system. And so that way, you know, for our band, like we could be in the heavy metal tier, and, you know, that money's still not evenly distributed. It's still not perfect, but at least you're not sort of paying, you know, Lord with an E or Cardi B or, well, you know, all these people, like, you know, and the money's just going to a Sony or a whatever.
Well, and there is actually a model for this. They call it user-centric payouts. And one of the competitors to Spotify called Deezer uses it. So I guess, like, anyone's listening, that's probably like the one thing to check out is this user-centered payouts idea. And the basic thing behind that is if, like, someone spends most of their month listening to Lord or Lord with an E, that particular monthly subscription fee will be divided according to what that particular person listened to.
Right.
As opposed to the system where it works at the moment, where anyone's monthly subscription is divided according to the system's total listens as a whole. And I think that's what I mean. Like I should probably stop banging on about this, but ultimately I think that, like, the basic idea, it comes back to that point that, like, the model is there. It's not massively unfair on the face of it, and it wouldn't require a massive amount of restructuring from how music currently works. And it would make things a lot fairer for the artist without particularly changing things that much for the end listener. The only people that would be affected too badly would be like the equivalent of the Monopoly guy, and let's not pretend we care about them too much.
No, not really. No, no. But I guess it's like anything, you know. It's like, you know, a number of different industries and politics and things like that. You can't just expect change to happen because it's the right thing to do. And so it's only when it becomes a benefit to others that there's enough influence to change things. So these platforms or these structures that appear to make more sense for an individual artist, then I guess it's, you know, you need those creative people to be able to go, okay, this is the goal, this is what we need to change, but then framing it in a way where your Monopoly guys and everything like that are going to see it from a different angle and hopefully see enough value to allow it to happen and not be severely negatively impacted by it. And that's a tough thing to do because, I mean, in the end, if they're holding on to these structures for grim life, then good luck trying to change it. Sort of like the lobbyists in politics and things like that.
Yeah, musicians are a unique bunch of people. Like, my sort of observation from being around them for like several decades now is that, like, we're a pretty good lot, and generally, like, we have our hearts in the right place. We're really good at advocating for people that aren't us.
Yeah.
You know, like, what we've achieved just even in Australia, like, around bushfires, marriage equality, racial justice, you know, like the amount of, like, the ability of a creative community to move the needle on those issues is pretty considerable, right? I think it's just, like, a lot of it is our reluctance to speak for ourselves. And I think particularly in Australia, the fear of being seen as, like, ungrateful or having ideas above your station for wanting to have both the pleasure of making music and be paid fairly for it at the same time, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Tricky one. Anyway, we should probably change the topic.
Well, I think it's going to be a common theme. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, you know, for me over the past year, sort of Patreon in particular has been a bit of a game changer for me mentally. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not making a lot of money, but I think it just opens me up sort of from just looking at the longer term sort of picture and going, there is a way to be able to do things that you love and earn some money. And it may not cover all your costs, but, you know, it can take the pressure off things that normally stop people. It's, you know, we've seen plenty of bands that have been amazing, and after 2 or 3 years of banging out in the circuit and not making much money, I'm just seeing fucking shit on my knee from Larry. thanks, Larry. They just fizzle out. They go, you know. And so I think things like that, it's a discussion point that's going to keep popping up in the future, because I think more and more bands need to understand that the old way of doing things is not the be-all and end-all, and there are other ways to get creative and earn a little bit of money just to take the pressure off, because usually it's money that stops everyone. And you know, great artists and great creatives end up going back to something mundane and soul-destroying because, you know, they've been forced to have to follow a particular lifestyle choice. So I think it's a timely topic and something that I think I'll be harping on about for quite some time. So I'm glad we spoke about it. But I will shift gears a little bit. I'm curious because last year you guys put out air quotes album, which was 3 EPs.
That's right.
And I think it was meant to be released. They were meant to be released separately. And then, well, it was 2020.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing was it's sort of like it was a very interesting lesson in how people will see things how they'd like to see it, because ultimately they kind of were released individually, but because it was a pandemic year, no one sort of so noticed that they were being released. And then it was always the intention to then package them as a kind of like sort of collection thing of these like 3 things that were done.
Yeah.
And so the press was just like, oh, that's an album, isn't it? Okay, cool. And so that was like the fourth album, which is kind of weird because we're in the process of like demoing the next one, which we are still anachronistically referring to as album number 4. So we should probably probably change that because that's not how other people see it.
Yeah, that's tough, isn't it? Because I mean, it comes down to framing everything, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's in your head and what you want to put out there. If somebody's already taken the narrative and spun it in their own way, then it's a case of, well, how much resistance do I show to that and ignore that? Or do I just sort of give in a little bit and let that narrative go? I mean, even for us, like, you know, when we did the last album, we've been releasing stuff nonstop over the years, like, you know, EPs and live albums and re-recordings and all sorts of stuff. But then one guy who is a great friend and he always means well, and it actually worked in our favor, but he wrote first album in 6 years. And Tim in our band, he went, what the fuck? It sounds like we've been doing nothing. He goes, look at all this stuff we've been doing. We've been putting out Hustling for so long and touring and all this sort of stuff. And then after about 30 seconds or so, we sort of went, actually, this is really good because it makes it sound like it's a bit of a comeback. It sounds a little bit more hyped up. And that's what that person was trying to do. And so we went from a knee-jerk reaction of resisting it to then sort of embracing it and going, let's run with that narrative. And then we can just sneak in. Oh, by the way, we have been doing some other stuff along the way as well. So that must be tough for you guys. I mean, you know, initially having sort of a thought of how you want to put things out and you've sort of done it to an extent, but then I guess, you know, the media sort of interpreting it a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of it's a funny reflection on sort of yeah, just some of the interesting aspects of sort of putting your art out into the world and I suppose through that kind of business mechanism. But really, it was a really positive experience at the same time, like overall. It was good for us because we decided to record and mix the albums in-house with me doing that. So I found that like a really pleasant, engaging kind of thing to do. And I think that also allowed us sort of the comfort to stretch out and explore some different things creatively, I suppose, you know, because you're not on studio time. We've worked with great people, but it's always been a factor in the past, you know, like what's the schedule? What's the timeline? When are we going into the studio? How much time do we have? Yeah. You know, so you can't stretch out to the same extent. So that was really nice. And then it was honestly just really nice and happy that during a year that was so difficult for a lot of people that I guess people still gave a shit about what we did. We're a pretty quiet band. Like, we are not fantastic at engaging with our fans. Yeah. And they have stayed very loyal to us despite the fact that that we don't do that. So it was really, really nice to ultimately get that music out, which is the most important thing for us, and have that be recognized. And even though people didn't listen to it as three EPs and reviewed it as an album, what I was happy is they did detect like the core emotional motivation behind it for us, which was to try different things. And people, I think, appreciated that we weren't creatively resting on our laurels or just doing the same post-rock song over and over again, you know?
Is that something, sort of looking back now, that will be something in isolation in itself? Or has that sort of sparked where you guys are at now, sort of putting together songs, starting to demo stuff for what will be, well, you know, in a circle, album four, our circle, album five. Has it sort of influenced, or was it more of a case of that was an experiment to try a bunch of things and the majority of that stuff will just stay there?
No, I think we're going to take that approach and run with it for sure. I think, you know, honestly, we are at a point where, like, I think in terms of our profile, we might move the needle up and down to a certain extent, but we're probably like in the section of the industry we're going to be.
Yeah.
We're not going to get like, you know, massively bigger. And in a way, that's kind of cool because it means you don't have to worry about that. And then you can sort of think about, let's just be like the best little, unique post-rockish band we can be in this sort of little section of the industry that we are in. And so it was, I guess, really gratifying that people recognize that thing that we were sort of signaling, I suppose, in a way, in this context of smaller EPs. And that's definitely something we want to persevere with. Might be a weird reference, but like I've often been trying to think about album 4/5 coming up, is it's like, let's try and make our version of the Black Album. Like, in the sense of what I mean by that, where like sort of like, and Justice for All is kind of like made of breath only for us, like we sort of tried to sort of push the sort of musicianship and progressive side of things to like a maximum. And maybe sort of like as an artist, you listen back to some of your material and you think like some things worked better than others. And I think there were moments in our past on that record where maybe got lost in the flurry of notes a bit. So sort of like, I do think about a lot of what we do in terms of like the canon of heavy metal, because that's like basically my sort of, that was sort of, they were my texts growing up, you know, listening to that kind of stuff. So
Well, there you go. I mean, that could be an angle for the media for the next album. It's like a quote. This will be the equivalent of our Black Album. But I guess, I mean, you mentioned before about, you know, maybe not being the best with engagement and things like that online. My sort of perception of that is, if anything, it probably works in your favor with just the type of music and the image that you guys have put out there over the years, where you don't necessarily have to be very loud. You don't have to have a lot of public opinions about things. You sort of, the music does a lot of the talking, and probably the community that you've built over the years probably appreciates that. And that's probably why they're just there. And you don't have to sort of be sort of proactively sort of checking in with everybody and posting content and keeping that machine going. But sort of last year with putting out the releases, and going into this year, has sort of, I don't know, the lack of touring and just the world being turned upside down, has that sort of changed the sort of thought process for you guys moving forward with the band? Like how you function as a band, how you manage yourselves as a band? Is there more of a balance with other things in life now, or there's a lot of unknowns?
Yeah. So I think, to be really candid, I think I personally haven't really been affected too much by sort of lack of playing live. I love being on the stage and playing, but a lot of the other stuff around touring, I find, I used to love it. Now sort of I'll crack 35 this year. And at that point, it's sort of like, I don't want to never do it again, but I'm probably like pickier about that stuff than I was before. That's just sort of like life changing you and how you feel about things. I know that Otto definitely is a lot more upset about the lack of opportunity to play live. So I guess, you know, like there's always that difference of opinion. Definitely. I think that like we came out of the pandemic pretty well because our fans supported us. They recognized what we did. And also I think it goes back to what I was saying about like the difficulties of breaking into the marketplace in this new situation. We'd already got there. And since, like, as I said, alluded to, like, you know, becoming an old fart, you know, it's like we're just kind of approaching that period in our career where we're fortunate that we have the established career and people that want to listen to us, and there wasn't really internal pressure on us to want to tour a whole lot anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like taking away something that we'd already decided we didn't particularly want in it or need in the same way. So for us personally, it was not so bad. I have a really ambivalent feeling about the whole pandemic because it's actually a terrible situation for the world, but the way I've reacted to it personally, it's actually been quite good in my life in a way. Yeah. It's sort of forced some personal changes and stuff like that. So my perspective on what it's doing to the industry is probably different from a lot of people. I haven't had to go through the experience of seeing something that I felt I really needed in my life at that point being taken away. And I guess I just have nothing but sympathy for those people in the industry that, you know, for like, you know, I suppose reasons of like self-esteem or financial reasons just can't do what needs to happen in their life now because this thing isn't available. It's pretty complicated.
It's very complicated. And I think it comes down to a mixture of like, you know, obviously whatever situation you're in and how much time you've invested into different aspects of music and your identity. I mean, the identity thing's a huge thing, but that's been stripped away. You can't act on that identity anymore, or it's been paused. So that can be difficult for people. But I think it comes down to also sort of looking at it and what decisions you're going to make in that particular setting, in that time. It's sort of like, well, I can... And this is always easy to talk about, you know, and sort of suggest that people do. When you're in the thick of it, it's very hard to do. So I'm always conscious of that. But, you know, you can sit here and you can sort of go, well, this is all fucked and everything's falling apart and there's always these really challenging things that are happening around me. And then on the other side of it, sort of looking at it and going, well, what can I actually do? Like, what can I do? What can I do to try and make the most of this situation, even if it's not much, but just to try and keep things moving? And I've seen really good examples of people that have had things just crumble away from them and they've managed to sort of come out the other side with a different perspective, some optimism, maybe picked up some new skills, whether they wanted to or not, or just a different appreciation for what is existing and what they have. But it's easier said than done, of course, but it's good to like just to hear you say that, because I think it is doom and gloom for a lot of people and it's been really hard, but I think that's not the whole story. And I think there are people that have been able to sort of just find some inner peace or some sort of fulfillment or at least some purpose during this time, which is a little bit inspiring for other people who may be trying to find that themselves.
I think you're totally right. I think it's an inherently complicated situation. The complete same effects manifest in different lives in very different ways, right? One of the things that, being honest, I certainly wasn't like my best self at the beginning of the pandemic. Like, I think I probably had like a few weeks of like dread and self-pity sort of, you know, I was like working in the live music industry. You know, I lost a bunch of work. I had seven years of tax I hadn't filed and I had to apply for JobKeeper as a sole trader. So
that might actually work out in your favor long term. So I managed to clean that up.
That's sort of but that's kind of a really like dumb, funny example of sort of like sometimes hardship will hit people and hit them so bad and it's not their fault, but they just like kind of crumble for a bit and, you know, it can do real damage. And then other times hardship hits you and it's sort of just like a glancing blow and it might just sort of snap you out of maybe some sort of complacency that you're in. And I think it's sort of like those two things I've described are true facts about what has happened in this situation. And I think it's very normal in a situation like this that's so distressing for us to like look out into the world and want to see the particular thing that's happened to us be validated or comforted by how things are being arranged and going on out there. That doesn't happen a whole lot of the time, I suppose. And my way of dealing with it is just trying to be sympathetic to myself and just like feel as much kindness and solidarity for the people out there that are, you know, being affected ultimately. For me, the positives have, you know, once I didn't have that opportunity to do this sort of work in live music that I was doing, I sort of reoriented. I started doing more work in another area I've been working in, which is doing support work for sort of people on the NDIS. Okay. So I was able to sort of like get some JobKeeper to tide me over and sort of pivot to doing that other thing. And honestly, it's just given me a lot of time to play guitar, and like I saved up some money and I got a puppy and sort of stuff like that. And ultimately, again, like you, I'm not going to sort of tell other people that what worked for me will work for them. But I think just sort of arriving at this point and being, for me, it was like the pandemic is just a reminder of the situation we were already always in. Life is always precarious. You never know what's coming around the corner. And as humans, you know, we have a limited time on, and things will come along and totally unend our plans. So it was sort of like, in that way, I ended up not thinking of it as something different to life as normal. It was just quite a stark reminder of what normality actually is, which is this quite uncertain thing in which we're all trying to like make our way. And then getting to that point, it wasn't exactly like a sort of lovely realization, but it did give me some sort of space to think, well, this is what it is now, you know, and I may as well go and try and do some things that make me happy, that I have the opportunity to do today. And it's not that bad to be able to, you know, sit at home for a fair amount of the time and try and teach yourself how to play Morbid Angel on guitar. So, you know, like that's sort of like been my
there's
my,
the glass half full. I think the thing that makes it so unique, I mean, obviously, you know, what's been going on globally, but I think it's just a case of, you're right, where everyone, life is just ups and downs all the time. There's uncertainty, you know, everyone used to talk about the old school sort of, you know, get a job and job stability, and your parents just work the same job for decades and blah, blah, blah. And there's no such thing as job stability. Like, you know, you might think you got a job tomorrow and something can completely change and everything gets turned upside down. I think the thing that makes it so unique this time, and it hasn't been felt for, well, probably since the beginning of the 1900s, is that the world's feeling more or less the same sort of thing in, you know, it's a very common shared feeling. I mean, everyone's got their own stories, but more or less we're all being impacted by something at the moment. And so to be able to separate yourself and then sort of look at yourself objectively and sort of look at your own life in isolation and go, this is what life's all about. It's up and down. It's very hard to do that because you log in the Facebook, you log on the Twitter or whatever it might be, or you just, you see family, you go down to the cafe or the pub or something like that. And that's, everyone's talking about the same thing. Yeah. And so how do you not get swept up in that and try and keep some way of protecting yourself in that isolation to go, what has actually happened to me? Is everything else that's going around that everybody else is being impacted by, is that actually happening to me to the extent that everybody else is feeling it? And what do I actually need to do? Do I even need to do anything? Maybe the thing I need to do is just stop scrolling on my phone so much each day, and that might just take the pressure off the situation.
I was really tough on myself. Like when I started losing my pot a bit at the beginning, worrying about it, I just sort of instituted a no news rule for like days at a time. I would be like, I'm just going to like allow myself one one sort of check-in on like boring old ABC news a day, just to sort of like, you know, read one update, and then I'm not going to read any other takes about it, and I'm just going to get on with my life. And it's a really tricky thing. Like, social media is pretty bad for my mental health. I try to sort of avoid it because, as I said before, I'm an egregious hater. So like, it doesn't bring out it doesn't bring out good things in me that I like. But it's also like, as a musician, as a creative person, it honestly does me damage not being there, you know, not participating, not putting myself out there as well. So it's a tricky thing. And that just really, I think, speaks to the bind that we're in as well. These things come along. We want to try and understand them, you know, to feel secure. But a lot of the things we do to try and understand it actually make us feel less secure than we even did before. It's really quite a difficult thing. I think the best thing is as you said, to sort of try and reflect on what's going on in your life, what's actually happening for you in the present moment, and to like use a cliche, I suppose, be mindful of what's like going on for you literally, and not getting caught up in stories that other people might be spinning. Those people don't have your best interests at heart. You do.
Yeah.
You know what's good for you. Yeah. I think we so much of our lives has been reorientated around forgetting what's actually going on for us and getting caught up in these kind of larger meta narratives. So yeah, staying out of it definitely has helped me a fair bit for sure.
It's a tough one. It's really tough. And I think the more, at least for myself, the more that I mean, one of the best things I did, sounds so silly, but you know, I turned on that little notification thing on my iPhone where it shows me the screen time. And so it'll say, screen time's down 10% or whatever, or it's up 6%, and then it'll show you the total amount of time per day. And when I first started doing that, that was the shock to the system, where I thought, this is not good for anybody, like for me to be on my phone that much. And so having that awareness then started a bit of a chain reaction for myself, where I'm a little bit more conscious of why I'm on my phone, or why I'm on a laptop and you know, using Twitter or Facebook or Instagram and all that sort of stuff. What's the purpose? What's the intention behind it? And what am I actually getting? And there's value at times, but for the most part, there's a lot of time wasting as well. So I think for me, just due to having just the slight tinge of awareness, has then forced me to start looking a little bit more in myself, trying to find ways to sort of understand my own human behavior, how I tick, and just a little bit of a bit of self-care, and a little bit of sort of I was going to use the term mental hygiene in a way, because it's just a way of just trying to just get a little bit more clean and just understand that, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're sort of taking in is garbage, you know, and it doesn't do us a service.
I think that's really true. I mean, I'm very on that trip you describe of sort of like mental hygiene, trying to keep the mind clear. I certainly don't want to evangelize, but I joined like a Western Buddhist meditation group during the pandemic as sort of one of my ways of sort of looking after myself and trying to better myself during that time. I think that stuff works for me pretty well. I think what I've noticed in people is something that you just described really well, is this sense that this communication that's happening around us is putting difficult things into our minds that are distracting us from what we really want to do. And then we feel guilty about that, and we feel like we need to kind of expunge these things out of us. But nonetheless, we feel compelled to return to the phone. You know, I probably don't spend a lot of time scrolling my phone so much, but I do spend like a whole lot of time watching dumb videos on YouTube. So it's sort of like we all fall into that. I think for me, it's really helped to, I suppose, just return to your existence as a human being. The news is the news. But there's a home you live in. There's a neighborhood you're part of. You can walk around it. You can grab a cup of coffee. You know, like these kind of things are very meaningful. They're not nothing. And ultimately, it's like most of what life is comprised of, I suppose. Yeah. And I've honestly found a lot of refuge in that. It's like definitely kept me on the straight and narrow during this point. Yeah.
I wish I knew in advance about your Buddhist stuff. I would have just done a whole podcast. I'm thinking, do I check the time? Oh yeah, we've been talking for a while. Maybe we'll catch up again and do a chat about some of that stuff. Because that's fascinating, and I think it's obviously an intention that you've made to try and improve some aspects of your life. And I think that's a common theme that a lot of people are feeling at the moment. It's like, well, what can I do with what I've got? And how can I just get better with my own circumstances and cutting out a lot of noise and just trying to control, what's in front of us. And as, like even yesterday, I was sort of walking down the street here, just coming back from the post office, and I was just looking at the buildings and I was just thinking, like, I've been in, like, in Belgrade. I've seen bombed out buildings. We were watching the news last year with, what happened in Beirut, and we've seen like all these horrible things happening around the world. And I'm sort of walking down going, all the buildings are still upright here. Like, everything's still intact. People are walking around. No one's death staring each other. Everyone's just getting on with life. And yeah, the cafes are open, things like that. And so I just think, okay, my circumstances, fuck, things are okay. And there might be things that I'm not happy with and I want to improve, but that's manageable versus the hype and the noise around us in the world. So I'll pick your brain about some of that other stuff another time as well, because that sounds fascinating that you sort of taken that plunge.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose like the only thing I just want to say on that is like, I guess if like anyone, for me, it's sort of been really nice to, I suppose, like give yourself permission to imagine that like stuff can be all right outside of like the, I suppose, like the miserable cycle of sort of like reading the news and feeling like depressed around the world. Depressed about the world. Like I know that not everyone, but there are some people out there, stuck in this cycle of consuming information about the world, trying to know more about it, and it doesn't actually make you any happier to just know more about it. I listened to this one guy, an old Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur who's a bit of a hippie himself, called Jaron Lanier, and he kind of advocates essentially sort of a kind of non-participation in social media, not for everyone. He doesn't think it's going to be suitable for everyone or that it's an inherently evil thing, but he sort of makes the argument, if there are some people that exist outside of that kind of discussion, then it can only enrich our human world to have people sort of having different perspectives. Some people existing within that conversation, having some of like the very interesting stuff that goes on in Twitter and sort of making that happen. And then having people outside as well, that have a perspective that isn't informed by those kind of dynamics. And I guess that like, if the idea of not being on social media for a while appeals in any way, like give it a shot. For me, like taking 6 months off was, and just kind of like committing to do that, it can be quite transformative. If it's the kind of thing where people have an inkling that they feel that could be a thing that works for them, it's an interesting perspective to take on life for a while. And I've been like on and off, so I've never sort of been, this isn't my first rodeo in terms of like getting off social media. So I'm not trying to be on my high horse or anything like that,
Well, it might be just the case that by having even, a week off or a month off or whatever it might be, that when you do come back, it's just not as engulfing and obsessive as what it was beforehand. You've been able to sort of get that outside perspective and go, oh, that's what life was like before we all got sucked into news feeds and things like that. So when you come back, that sparkle, that flair is just not quite the same as what it was before, because now you've got something else. You got a different reference point. So there you go. Maybe, I don't know if I could do it, eh? Fuck. Oh man, that's a scary thought, just given everything that I do. But hey, you know.
But it's also like different strokes for different folks, right? Like I am a, and that's why I sort of like, I try and put this disclaimer around. It's like, if you, I know there are people like me and there are probably people like you, like I've always been a bit of a sort of like, you know, I suppose more socially reclusive than others. You know, I probably feel more, I feel more comfortable reading an encyclopedia article than I do sort of like reading a news feed. And that's just like the way I'm wired, and it's not better or worse. And I suppose like someone like me gets on social media and I'm no use. I'm just like spending all of my time feeling angry about it. And like occasionally I get on a thread and say like something dumb because I'm fed up, and I'm just no good there, you know? And it's sort of like someone like me is more useful, I suppose, like being outside of that, reporting back. Whereas I know that there are people in that world that just wield it like a weapon. I can't, like, how people manage to use a Twitter account for good, like they do, but it's like some arcane art to me, you know, like
struggle.
I don't know where you would it's quite impressive to me that someone would like have the sort of like gift and mental fortitude to have like literally millions of followers and being able to like use them for a generally good purpose. You know, it's like, it's pretty incredible. Said,
different strokes of different folks. And that's what, I mean, that's what makes it interesting. And that's why it's so difficult at the same time. You know, it's not just one blueprint. Thanks, Larry. There's not one blueprint for everybody, you know? So it's, you know, it comes down to your own circumstances and assessing. But I think, with Larry using me as a jungle gym, and he just came over to sit with you for a moment, I think we might wrap it up. But Alex, thanks for coming by. And I was going to ask, I mean, you might not have any info to share at the moment, but have you got an idea of with new stuff this year or anything that you can share? Or is it more of a case of just sort of early stages at the moment?
We are definitely very clear about using this year to write another record.
Yep.
And to sort of make it a bit more of a traditional, you know, our answer to the Black Album, obviously, yep. You know, our kind of record. So that will be this year. I think that like we did have some tour dates scheduled for later in the year, but I think like they're probably unlikely to go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like, that's the time that it is. But yeah, like, and maybe we will get around to doing something interesting, like some kind of update on social media or some other kind of interesting content. If we can drag ourselves away from like grinding away at our pre-production demos, you know?
Well, I'll chuck links in, and obviously the EP/album from last year, and people can follow and check out all the stuff. But mate, thanks for coming by, and thanks for being patient with this little guy. I mean, he's just an absolute shit today, but
anyway. I quite liked him, you know. I mean, I know probably like from your perspective it's really frustrating, but you know, I'm all about Larry, you know. Yeah. I think he's pretty great.
I should do a little
he's cute as a button too.
Oh, he's a character. I should just do a quick little selfie or see if I can get all of us in here just so we can see. All right, go and check out the latest EP trilogy, These Are Not Your Dreams, over at Bandcamp, sleepmakeswaves.bandcamp. Of course, go to sleepmakeswaves.com, where all the links to everything Sleep Makes Waves is there to go and check out. Alex is not really on the socials himself, as you probably would have got from that chat with him. However, he is part of the band accounts, so definitely reach out to him via the band accounts on the socials and let him know what you thought of this episode. Now, before we wrap it up, of course, patreon.com/AndyDowling. A great way to support this podcast. The Beluga Boy t-shirts have been unleashed. They are available now. So go and pre-order your t-shirt, and they will be sent out in the post, hopefully in the coming weeks. But if you're joining on Patreon, and you would have noticed, the top tier actually gives you access to a free t-shirt every quarter. 4 free t-shirts a year will be sent out to you, including free shipping worldwide. So if you join that top tier, you will get access to 4 new designs every year. Eventually, when I do get a few extra people on that top tier, I will also include an exclusive tiered Patreon t-shirt design every year for those people in particular. But for now, this is how it works. Free t-shirts on the top tier of Patreon. If you're on Patreon, whether it be the $1 tier right up to the $20 tier, you can get cost price for any of the merch that I have available. And then anybody else who hasn't joined on Patreon, you can go and grab it over at Bandcamp at theandysocialpodcast.bandcamp.com. So it's all there. Lots of things are happening in Patreon. And as always, I mention, and I'm a broken fucking record with this stuff, the people on Patreon are the reason why Andy Social exists in 2021. It's the reason why we've upped it to 2 guest episodes per week. We're firing on all cylinders, and it is because of the legends over at Patreon. So please consider joining and supporting the podcast from only $1 a month, dirt cheap, set and forget, you won't even notice, blah, 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 blah. You understand the drill. Before we wrap it up, there'll be another episode coming later this week on Wednesday morning. And this is a new guest, somebody who does a very similar thing to me, a little bit of podcasting, loves to talk to musos in particular. And I've been doing a lot of that recently, as you would have noticed from the past several episodes of the podcast this year. So stay tuned for that one. As always, do all the social stuff. If Patreon's not your thing, the best ways to support this podcast is, of course, listening to me right now. Thank you very much. But also doing the social media love, liking, love-hearting, retweeting, commenting, sharing, all that sort of stuff, and sharing the podcast around to as many different people as possible, leaving reviews, rating, reviewing on places like Apple Podcasts or even wherever the hell you can leave a review and rate. You know how it all works. People listen to podcasts in all different places over the internet. So all that stuff helps. It's a massive, massive help to keep this podcast chugging along. So thank you very much to the people who continue to support the podcast. Enough crapping on from me because I'm losing my voice. See you later. Bye-bye. Ta-ta.
Larry, please.